Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Bruce Chesson for his always entertaining and informative take on clinical research in NHL and CLL, and he began by commenting on chronic lymphocytic leukemia.
There are a number of options for patients with CLL now, and several of which are approved by the FDA. Of course, there are fludarabine-based regimens, which around 1990 revolutionized how we treated CLL. There were several randomized studies showing fludarabine was better than alkylating agent-based therapy. And with the availability of rituximab, FR and related regimens became the standard. And whether you believe FR or FCR is the preferred regimen, between the two of them, they've dominated the field for a number of years. More recently, two other drugs have been approved for the initial treatment of CLL. One of them is alemtuzumab, which is an anti-CD52 monoclonal antibody, which beat up on chlorambucil in a randomized trial, as most things do in randomized trials. But it doesn't tend to be widely used because of its predilection for inducing opportunistic infections. And when you give it intravenously, which is the approved route of administration, it's associated with considerable shake and bake, rigors, fevers, et cetera. In fact, the first person I ever treated with it ended up in the intensive care unit with hypotension and shakes. Now that we give it subcutaneously, it's better tolerated. Whether it is as effective is a bit controversial. The absorption is a little slower, so it takes you a little longer to get the blood levels that you need. But more recently than that has been bendamustine. Bendamustine is a drug that's been around since the 60s, developed in Jena in East Germany in the GDR, and it hung around there until the wall came down, and it became more widely studied in a variety of tumor types, including CLL, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and even some solid tumors and multiple myeloma. And based on some studies from Germany, it resulted in a phase 3 trial, again against chlorambucil, and it had a higher overall response rate and a higher complete response rate. But more importantly, the primary endpoint was progression-free survival, which was significantly longer with bendamustine compared with chlorambucil, leading to its approval by the FDA.
What did you think about the paper looking at secondary myeloid cancers or leukemias, MDS, in patients FR versus FCR?
The numbers in that study for the occurrence of secondary neoplasias were very low in both arms. And the difference, while being close to statistically significant but not even, was probably not clinically different. They're trivial percentages of patients. That's another potential advantage of bendamustine. There are several lines of data suggesting that fludarabine does not lead to secondary malignancies. I published a paper in JCO a number of years looking at the three popular nucleoside analogs of the day, pentastatin, fludarabine, and cladribine. And out of thousands of patients, it was hard to show that there was an increase in malignancies over baseline. That was supported by subsequent studies. However, there are, of course, contradictory data. Having said that, the data with bendamustine, even though it is in part an alkylating agent, do not suggest that it's associated with an increased incidence of secondary malignancies, at least in lymphoma. It remains to be seen in randomized trials whether that's true in CLL or not. There was a study done by Matthias Rummel of R-CHOP versus R-bendamustine up front, and in the relapse setting, R-bendamustine versus R-fludarabine. And both up front and in the relapse setting, there were fewer secondary malignancies with the bendamustine-containing regimen than the other two regimens. So I'm a little concerned about FCR, which is one reason that I tend to use BR and I used to use FR. So it's something that will require a longer follow-up to see if more cases do develop, but it is something to be cautious about.
You mentioned that part of the mechanism of action of bendamustine, I guess, is thought to be an alkylating agent. What do we know right now about the mechanism of action of this agent?
Well, there's very little known about it. There is actually one good paper published by Lorenzo Leone in Clinical Cancer Research a couple of years ago. It is non-cross resistant with other alkylating agents, and it has a moiety which is more like a nucleoside analog, although it doesn't function like a nucleoside analog. It induces a number of changes in DNA, one of which is called mitotic catastrophe, where things divide, but the cell doesn't, and the cell dies.
That's one of my favorite terms.
I love it. A great term. Whoever coined that
what is
some
it?
Kind of prize. The inner workings of the cell act like the cell is ready to undergo division. Things separate and divide, but the cell itself doesn't divide, so the cell dies. And it also induces, like everything else seems to do, apoptosis. But it's really not totally clear how it works. It's a mystifying drug. When I first became involved with it, like everybody else, I thought it's just another dumb alkylating agent, but it really isn't. When you combine bendamustine with something else, you have to lower the dose, even if it's rituximab.
You mentioned that bendamustine has been looked at in solid tumors and myeloma. What's been seen?
Well, we reviewed all these data in a JCO paper that I wrote with Matthias Rummel a couple of years ago. And in fact, it was approved in Germany for breast cancer at one point.
Wow.
And lung cancer. And in myeloma, it's very active and is being more widely studied. It was studied over in Europe. Everything was done in Germany primarily because that's where the drug was discovered. It's very active, and there are now a number of studies looking at it in myeloma to see if we can improve on the efficacy of other regimens. It's an interesting drug. You can really give fairly whopping doses of it, although you don't want to do that too often. There really has not been a careful determination of the maximum tolerated dose of bendamustine. That's why the regimens that we currently use, we've been saddled with because that's what's approved, but they were very empiric. And it's unfortunate because we don't know the optimal dose and schedule of the drug. But it is active in, as I said, breast and lung, myeloma, CLL, lymphomas. It's very active in Hodgkin's lymphoma. There was a report from Sloan Kettering of a 75% response rate in relapsed and refractory Hodgkin's.
Wow.
Not durable, but good enough that it got people who were not transplant candidates in good enough shape to undergo stem cell transplant.
Getting back to CLL, what are some of the new agents and strategies that are being looked at and trials that are out there that you consider? Let's start out with ofatumumab.
Right. There are a number of interesting drugs that are being developed for CLL. Fortunately, they are mostly biological and targeted agents. The days of new chemotherapy drugs is fortunately passing us by. There are a bunch of monoclonal antibodies. There are now about 10 anti-CD20s either available or in clinical trials. Ofatumumab is the one approved by the FDA for fludarabine and alemtuzumab refractory patients. The response rates in that patient group were approaching 50%, but there are some concerns about that drug. I've had a lot of experience with it and found that the infusion reactions actually seem to be greater than with rituximab. Whether a novel CD20 will take over for rituximab will be determined by one of two factors. Either it's got to be more effective or it's got to work when rituximab doesn't. Bill Weirda from MD Anderson has presented some data looking at the combination of FCO instead of FCR. And these data have been presented at international meetings. And the response rates, I think the overall response rate was around 83% with 40-something percent complete remissions around there, give or take a few percent, which is lower than has been reported with FR, FCR, and even BR. Now, whether the patient groups match with respect to prognostic factors remains to be seen when the full publication appears in a journal. So that's one interesting drug. And I've actually had some patients who had failed lots of prior therapies and had excellent responses to ofatumumab. So it does work in some patients. It's a reasonable option for patients who require additional treatment, as they all eventually do.
How do you conceptualize, the anti-CD20 effect in CLL compared to the indolent lymphomas biologically? Why is it that they don't seem to work as well?
Well, it depends on the CD20 because they're all somewhat different in whether they have more ADCC, more CDC, whether they bind more tightly, whether they bind as ofatumumab does to a different epitope, whether these things are really important clinically, and also whether it's used as a single drug, whether it's used in combination. All these things will impact on the efficacy of the drug. And it's probably because the difference in ADCC versus CDC being dominant in one versus the other may impact on that. In the old days, we used to say, well, it's because CD20 is less densely expressed on CLL cells and lymphoma. I don't think that that's a major factor because when you combine it with some other drug like fludarabine or bendamustine, things just work splendidly. So I'm not sure, but I think it's probably something along the lines of whether it's more CDC or ADC and depending on the CD20. Another CD20 that's out there and of interest is GA101. That has some interesting data in lymphoma and is now being studied along with bendamustine and CLL.
Are there upfront trials in CLL going on right now that you'd want to comment or that you're putting patients on?
There are some interesting studies. I think the most important study ongoing right now is the German CLL10 trial, which is FCR versus BR. And that may revolutionize how we approach this disease. There is an important intergroup study in the United States, which is looking at FCR versus FR versus FR followed by lenalidomide. And in fact, we have treated over 20 patients at our institution with FR followed by lenalidomide. And a few of the responses after FR have converted from PRs to CRs. So that may be another interesting strategy because lenalidomide is another potentially interesting drug in CLL.
How long is the lenalidomide used in the study?
It's at least 6 months.
So it's a maintenance strategy.
It's a maintenance strategy for 6 to 12 months. In that range. In the relapse setting, there have been two studies, one from MD Anderson with a response rate of around 35%, and the other from Roswell Park with a response rate of around 45%. It has some interesting adverse effects, notably tumor lysis syndrome and a tumor flare reaction, where after the first week or two of the drug, the lymph nodes get really big, they get really painful, you can get a leukocytosis, and then it all seems to go away. It's an interesting drug. By itself, it's okay, but like other drugs, it works better when you combine it or sequence it with other agents. In fact, we have a phase 1 of bendamustine and lenalidomide. One arm is CLL and one arm is lymphoma.
This is without rituximab?
It is without rituximab until we determine the maximum tolerated dose of that combination. Then we're going to add rituximab because I suspect then we'll have to back off on the dose of the other drugs.
You mentioned tumor lysis syndrome. What's your experience been with tumor lysis and CLL in general?
Well, again, we reported the incidence of tumor lysis syndrome in a few thousand cases of CLL back in the old days treated with fludarabine in the range of 0.43%. But now with some more effective drugs and drugs working by other mechanisms of action, such as lenalidomide, we're seeing it more often. Not always clinical tumor lysis syndrome, sometimes just chemical tumor lysis syndrome, fortunately. But the more potent the drugs you have, the more likely you're going to encounter tumor lysis syndrome.
So what kind of clinical situation would you start thinking about it in CLL, start doing something about it?
Well, I've found that it's hard to predict who's going to get it. We have patients who have white counts of over 100,000, and we've tended to put them in the hospital for their first cycle of FR or whatever we're using, and it's been a waste of 5 days. They can take the fluids at home and the allopurinol at home if they want. So there haven't been very good predictors of who's going to get it. There have been some risk scales that have been developed looking at such things as pretreatment uric acid, potassium, calcium and phosphorus levels, as well as the type of disease that's being treated. Obviously, Burkitt's and lymphoblastic lymphoma have a much higher frequency, And for those patients, then it becomes a question of, is it just fluids, is it allopurinol, or is it rasburicase?
What do we know about rasburicase in terms of how it works and when is it used?
Well, we tend to use it in high-risk patients, such as those that I mentioned, the lymphoblastics, some of the acute lymphoid leukemias, and patients who present with high uric acids who would think we're going to get rapid tumor lysis from our therapy.
Any side effects, toxicity issues with it?
No, I've had no toxicity issues with rasburicase at all. The only toxicity is financial.
What else is going on in CLL? What about new agents?
Well, other than the monoclonal antibodies, there are several new drugs that are interesting in CLL. One drug that has been resurrected by Mike Griever and John Bird is flavopiridol, which is a semi-synthetic flavone derivative, which has been around for a long time, but was so toxic and so ineffective that it was ready to get flushed. But these two figured out a more pharmacodynamically, pharmacokinetically driven schedule of administration, and the drug turns out has a response rate of over 50%. The problem still is its toxicity, inducing tumor lysis syndrome. You have to be fairly careful with its administration. But there are some other really cool drugs out there now. The two that immediately come to mind are Cal-101 and PCI-32765. Cal-101 is a PI3 kinase inhibitor directed against the P110 delta isoform. And it is an oral drug which is active against a variety of lymphoid malignancies. And in CLL, in the phase 1 and early phase 2 studies, almost every patient has exhibited some evidence of tumor reduction if you look at waterfall plots. And one interesting finding is that early on, while the nodes are shrinking, the spleen is shrinking, the bone marrow is getting better, and everything else is normalizing, the lymphocyte count's going up. So it's really hard to assess a response rate because there's clinical benefit and everything is getting better except for a lymphocyte count going up. So we are, in fact, planning a meeting in a few months, because this is not just with Cal-101, but with the other drug I'll mention, to try and develop more flexible response criteria for drugs based on perhaps different endpoints.
This is like a sequestration thing or a reverse sequestration
thing?
Yeah,
it's like a demargination thing.
Right.
So you can show CAT scans of tumors shrinking, and yet the lymphocytes going up. And so you can't call them a response, but if you look at decrease in tumor load, it occurs in almost everybody. And the other drug is the PCI-32765, which is a BTK inhibitor. What's a BTK inhibitor? Bruton's tyrosine kinase. That is downstream from the B cell receptor. And another oral drug with virtually no toxicity. And similar to Cal-101, you can demonstrate that the majority of patients with CLL exhibit a response.
These aren't TKIs, they're small molecules?
Yeah. And both these drugs are fascinating. It'd be great to put them together because you'd be nailing two pathways at the same time, but that would require some intercompany collegiality that's unusual these days.
And have these agents been looked at in solid tumors?
As far as I know, they are being looked at in solid tumors, but there are very sparse data at the present time. There are some data with Cal-101 and, I believe, prostate cancer, but I can't quote you the numbers.
Okay, let's talk about your 54-year-old woman with FL.
This 54-year-old woman presented with newly diagnosed follicular lymphoma, stage 3, clinically, but stage 4 when we did her bone marrow. Initially, she underwent watchful waiting. She did fine for a while, but then her disease progressed and she wanted to go on a vaccine trial. So she went on an anti-idiotype vaccine for which she was initially treated with rituximab, which was the required induction therapy. She didn't respond to rituximab. She had, at best, stable disease, and we were able to just watch her for a while, and she was removed from study. And she remained that way for a couple of years until March of 2007, when her disease was progressing sufficiently with bulky lymphadenopathy that she needed to be treated. And this was in the pre-bendamustine days and before we had a lot of the other drugs that we've been talking about today. And so we treated with Y90, ibrutimumab, tiexatan, radioimmunotherapy. And she attained a complete remission with absolutely no toxicity and remains in complete remission now, almost 4 years later.
At what point do you generally introduce RAI in your patients with FL?
Well, radioimmunotherapy is probably the most effective, least used drug in the treatment of lymphoma. We don't think of it as much as we might for a number of reasons. And there are differences in where you practice as to which these reasons are. In our practice, we have a lot of clinical trials. And now we have bendamustine, which is probably more effective, although probably more toxic. But the impediments to the use of radioimmunotherapy are numerous. One, it's expensive. And for a while, was not getting reimbursed adequately. Two, physicians have to refer the patient to somebody else, whether it be nuclear medicine physician or radiation oncologist. And maybe there's no one in their vicinity. Maybe they're in, I won't mention names of cities because someone will get angry if I mention their city, and there's no one within 100 miles. It's a little complicated. It requires timing with regard to the delivery of the drug. There are relatively strict exclusion criteria regarding bone marrow cellularity, extent of bone marrow involvement in follicular lymphoma. When they relapse, they often have extensive bone marrow involvement, and peripheral blood counts and amounts of prior radiation, etc. There are concerns that it may induce secondary leukemias. This has not been borne out by some retrospective comparisons to other therapies in similar patient populations. But what we do know is when you combine it with chemotherapy, there seems to be an increase in secondary malignancies. And there's also a concern as to whether there's life after radioimmunotherapy. If patients have it, does it wipe out their bone marrow to the point they can't receive other treatments? And the latter concern was somewhat dispelled by a recent update of the FIT trial, which was a study in which patients received chemotherapy, mostly alone, some with rituximab up front, and the responders were randomized to either Y90, ibrutimumab, tiexatan, or observation. And there was a longer progression-free survival in the treated arm. And in a subsequent analysis that was the update presented at the recent ASH meetings, they also looked at how patients responded to their next therapy. And there really wasn't much of a difference. So hopefully that will dispel some of those concerns. It's unfamiliar territory. There are very few patients treated in this country with either the Y90 drug or I-131 tocilizumab, the other commercially available agent.
When do you use these agents? In what situations?
Well, in fact, I just prescribed it for a patient yesterday. He was a chap who had progressed through R-CHOP, had a complete remission with bendamustine, but had some unusual complications. And that remission lasted several years. And now he had progressed, so he'd had the two most effective regimens for follicular lymphoma. And we offered him a number of clinical trials, and we discussed all the options. One of them I mentioned was radioimmunotherapy. And he went home and he read up on the various options, and he came back and he said he wanted radioimmunotherapy. It only takes 8 days to do it, day one and day eight, or six, seven, or eight, and you're done. You have a little myelosuppression 6 to 8 weeks later, and that's pretty much it. And he thought that would be a good option for him. So when you've run through R-CHOP and R-BENDA, if you're a candidate for radioimmunotherapy, and if there isn't a clinical trial available, then there's your treatment option.
You piqued my interest by saying unusual complication of bendamustine. What happened?
Well, the more we study drugs, the more adverse effects we encounter. And in fact, two that they've been looking at in greater detail have been rashes. And in the R-CHOP versus R-BENDA study, the only difference in favor of R-CHOP was that it had fewer rashes than R-bendamustine, and neurotoxicity. And this fellow got bendamustine alone, and after a couple of cycles, he developed confusion, failure to thrive. He became bedridden with delirium, encephalopathy, and profound weakness. This took several weeks, started to get better. We sent him to rehab, and it came back again. And we did everything known to man. We did multiple MRIs, LPs, you name it. And we couldn't find any cause for this. He was on no other medications. And it started a couple of months after the completion of his last cycle of bendamustine. And I just saw him the other day, and he's now back to probably more than 90% functional. But it took a long time to get over it. This has never been seen before with bendamustine and hasn't been seen since, and we've treated hundreds of patients with the drug. So we don't know why, but it was a serious problem.
So he's the only case report of it?
He's the only case report that's in the literature.
Getting back to RAI, what about use in the consolidation setting as was done in the FIT trial? Where is that heading? What about upfront therapy? There was a small trial out of University of Michigan. I don't know if anybody else has done it. Right. Or is this just all going to go away?
Right. Well, it is approved by the FDA for consolidation following response to upfront chemotherapy based on the FIT data. However, I have yet to see a patient treated in the community with that regimen. It hasn't caught on at all, again, because people have all those concerns about radioimmunotherapy.
Well, they're also using R maintenance, I think.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that I didn't mention, is they can give R maintenance in the office and just give it and give it and give it and give it. And so there are financial incentives to doing that. It has been used following CVP chemotherapy. John Leonard and Brian Link have some data following chemotherapy. And the chemotherapy alone didn't seem to induce any secondary leukemias, but the chemotherapy followed by radioimmunotherapy seemed to have a few secondary leukemias. So again, you get a little worried. The data you're referring to are Mark Kaminsky's patients. I believe there were 75 of them, published in the New England Journal a few years ago, in which all they got was I-131 tocilizumab as their initial treatment. The response rate was 95%. And the complete remission rate was around 75%. And most of the complete remissions remained in complete remission for a prolonged period of time, years. Some as long as 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. It has not caught on as frontline therapy because it's not approved as a single agent for frontline therapy, and it's very expensive.
I was kind of curious why it never really got studied in addition to that study.
Yeah. The only way it has been in consolidation. No one else that I know of has really looked at it as a single modality up front.
I'm curious about your take on the presentation at ASH on rituximab versus watch and wait. Can you talk about what they looked at, what they found, and what you thought about it?
Well,
and judging by how you responded to Prima at ASCO, I'm going to make my guesses, but go ahead and tell us.
Right. This was an interesting study done by the same investigators who a number of years ago published a very large randomized trial of chlorambucil versus watch and wait and showed no benefit. And there have been other studies from Stanford and elsewhere looking at something versus watch and wait showing no benefit. But here they said, okay, we've got rituximab, which is commonly used anyhow up front, has the potential for less toxicity than alkylating agents. Let's give it a whirl. It was a three-arm trial. It was watch and wait. It was four weekly doses, and then it was four weekly doses with 2 years of maintenance. The four weekly doses alone was dropped in midstream as a result of the PRIMA data. What they showed was that there was a significantly higher rate of disease progression in the watch and wait, no surprise, and time to next treatment, which was the primary endpoint, was significantly longer in the rituximab-treated patient population. But there was no survival difference. And what we know from some earlier studies, and what we'll, I hope we'll learn from the RESORT trial, which was four weekly doses and then retreatment upon relapse versus four weekly doses and a couple of years of maintenance.
It was actually, I think it was indefinite, wasn't it?
Yeah, indefinite maintenance, right.
Or maintenance until relapse.
Maintenance until relapse. There are some older studies suggesting that you can use rituximab again and the benefit may be equivalent to what you got from maintenance. And there are issues with rituximab maintenance. There's the expense, there's the nuisance, there's the risk of late infections and actually cytopenias, and there is the risk of impairing responsiveness to subsequent treatments. This has been seen in the transplant arena where patients who got, in the CORAL trial, who got a lot of previous rituximab had a worse outcome than patients who didn't. So, you know, whether their outcome of time to next treatment, which is sort of a soft subjective endpoint, is really enough to change practice was controversial. I ran into several people, some of whom were going, oh, come on, give me a break, and others who were accomplished lymphoma experts saying, that's going to change what I do. We need longer follow-up of these data to see if there's more toxicity, to see if there is any survival benefit that manifests itself. It's not changing my practice. I still have a lot of patients that I watch and wait. I've got some I've been following 7 years and longer with palpable disease who it doesn't change. Why should I treat these people? I'll treat them when they need it.
You know, it's funny. I was hearing about that study for so long. Everybody was anticipating it being presented. You know, it seemed like what they presented really wasn't too surprising.
Right.
And yet a lot of people like you are kind of going ho-hum.
Yeah. It wasn't surprising at all. These were low tumor burden patients. If you're going to treat these patients, there are probably better ways to do it while avoiding the toxicity. In CLGB, we have a program of biological doublets. The first study we did was a combination of, and these are previously untreated patients, no chemo, rituximab, galiximab, an anti-CD80. And in our low flippy patients, we had a 92% response rate with around 75% complete remissions. And almost none of the CRs had progressed. At the ASH meetings, we presented our second study, which was rituximab, eprituzumab, the anti-CD22. And we had an overall 84% response rate, but that included a number of high flippy patients. So these are much higher response rates than you can get with rituximab alone, and they seem to be very durable. In that second study I mentioned, none of the CRs had relapse, although it was relatively short follow-up.
What about bortezomib and FL? Bernard Coiffier presented a study at ASH looking at that.
Well, there were two schedules of bortezomib presented by that group at ASH. In one session, they looked at a regimen of 1.6 milligrams per meter squared weekly instead of the standard 1.3 days, 1, 4, 8, and 11. And they showed that the weekly was inferior to the more traditional approved schedule. In the Coiffier study, which was considered a pivotal trial, it was rituximab with or without bortezomib. And they used the 1.6 that they had already shown was inferior, which is troublesome. And this is an example of how you have to really look at the data carefully. And what they showed was that the response rates were a bit higher, but not statistically different. The progression-free survival was a bit longer, but it didn't meet the primary endpoint, which was a 33% increase in PFS. They had about a 22%. So in essence, it was a negative trial, although it's being reported as a positive study because there was a difference, but it wasn't the difference that they were looking for in the study. I think bortezomib is a drug that has activity, but I don't think it's going to go very far. We're now doing a number of studies looking at its role in follicular and mantle cell. We have a few studies we're developing in the cooperative group system of BR versus BVR, the V being Velcade for bortezomib. And we'll see whether it really does add, because we did a study called the Vertical Trial. And this was first a phase one and then a phase two of bendamustine, bortezomib, and rituximab in relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And we got a response rate of 83% with a bunch of complete remissions. But if you look at bendamustine, rituximab alone, in relapsed follicular lymphoma, we report a response rate of 92%. Does it add anything? I don't know, and the randomized trials will hopefully resolve that question.
What about the other proteasome inhibitors, particularly carfilzomib? Has that been looked at?
Carfilzomib has mostly been looked at in myeloma, and there is some very exciting data that I saw in your five-minute deal.
Right.
Paul Richardson's data showing very high response rate when you combine it with lenalidomide. There are limited data in lymphoma. The company, I hope, will be interested in pursuing it extensively in lymphoma because it should be at least as active as bortezomib, and it lacks the neurotoxicity, which has been very problematic.
I guess they're calling it, quote, an irreversible inhibitor, too. I don't know what that means.
You know, it means something in the test.
It means it's different, I guess.
Yeah. There are other irreversible inhibitors out there as well. There are several proteasome inhibitors in clinical trials. There's MLN9708 and some others. It'd be nice to have one that really worked that wasn't neurotoxic, because one thing they showed in the Coiffier study was a significantly higher rate of neurotoxicity in the bortezomib-containing arm. Most, but not all, were reversible.
Yeah, and you know, there's been I guess you mentioned the thing about the weekly maybe being less neurotoxic, and I think now there's a sub-Q formulation that's being looked at in myeloma. Let's talk a little bit about mantle cell, maybe just provide some comments about where we are with this disease and how you generally approach patients off-study.
Mantle cell lymphoma is a real challenge. It is only 6% of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and it's somewhat heterogeneous. We have some patients who don't require initial therapy, and the group from Cornell has published a paper, as have others now, showing that you can follow some patients for months to perhaps a couple of years without treating. On the other hand, you've got the blastic variant patients who are some of the most awful patients you'll ever see. Most of the patients, probably 80%+, are in the middle. They're the rest of the mantle cell lymphomas.
Before you go on, because we get a lot of questions about this, are there any biologic or tissue correlates, particularly to identify the indolent subset, or is it just a clinical assessment?
Well, the only real correlate is Ki-67, the proliferative index, and that tends to be lower in this group. There are some other clinical features, but it's not an all-or-nothing kind of thing. But if they have limited stage disease and it's not involving a major organ, and they have a relatively low Ki-67, you can sometimes watch these people without a problem.
Now, what about people who need to be treated?
People who need to be treated are generally divided into two basic groups based on age. The younger patients tend to get a regimen such as hyper-CVAD or developed at MD Anderson, based on some very interesting data, which were not reproduced when the Southwest Oncology Group tried to do so. Their results in the multicenter setting were not comparable to the single institution.
Seemed like a lot more toxicity, too.
They experienced considerable toxicity, such that the regimen is not tolerated by people over the age of 60 or 65 years and shouldn't be considered for those. Whether transplant is needed after that combination or other similar combinations is also questionable. It seems to be needed after hyper-CVAD, but whether it's really needed after our hyper-CVAD is debatable. But for younger patients, that seems to be the route that's chosen, aggressive chemotherapy followed by transplant.
What are you likely to do, incidentally?
Well, we are planning a clinical trial.
Okay, what's the trial?
In that patient population, looking at our hyper-CVAD followed by transplant versus R-bendamustine followed by transplant.
Wow.
The R-bendamustine data in upfront mantle cell lymphoma are a response rate of over 90% and a progression-free survival significantly better than regimen R-CHOP with considerably less toxicity. And since you're following both of those regimens with a transplant, if you can get away with less toxicity, maybe you can get more patients to the transplant. So that's the study that's currently in development as an intergroup effort among SWOG, CLGB, and ECOG.
How do you think that's going to go down with patients, particularly educated patients? It sounds like a tricky randomization.
It may be, and you can look at it one of two ways. They may walk in and they may say, wait a minute, our hyper-CVAD, I'm going to beat the hell out of my tumor, and that's what I want. On the other hand, they're going to say, wait a minute, this is a regimen that had a 90% response rate in mantle cell lymphoma, all age groups, all risk factors was better than R-CHOP, and it's much less toxic. If I can get to my transplant without all that morbidity, let's go for it. So remains to be seen.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking about, not even the response rate, just kind of thinking about, do I want to take R-bendamustine or R-hypercVAD, even though, granted, you know, you're going to get transplant either way. That's a major different path.
Yeah, those trials tend to be difficult, like transplant versus no trans, surgery versus no surgery. Those kind of trials are tough to recruit to. Hopefully we'll do it. For the older patients, the standard regimen is R-CHOP, and it's a terrible standard. It has a median time to progression of around 18 months. And again, as I mentioned, R-bendamustine was superior. So what we are going to be hopefully doing, and the study is still meandering through the intricacies of the Lymphoma Steering Committee and the NCI, is a study of BR followed by R maintenance based on some unpublished data suggesting that R maintenance may be useful, compared with BR followed by R lenalidomide maintenance, compared with BVR R maintenance and BVR RL maintenance.
What do we know about BVR maintenance? Well, for that matter, you know, B lenalidomide maintenance, just in terms of tolerability. I mean, it's used a lot in myeloma.
It's used a lot in myeloma.
But bortezomib, rituximab, lenalidomide maintenance?
It's going to be bendamustine, rituximab with lenalidomide maintenance. Bendamustine, rituximab with lenalidomide plus rituximab maintenance. And then the same things, but with bortezomib thrown in the induction as well.
Up front in the induction.
BR,
right.
R, BR, RL, BVR, R, BVR, RL maintenance.
Yeah, when you said you're doing a trial in these patients, I figured, okay, well, it's going to have bortezomib, but it's going to have lenalidomide, it's going to have bendamustine somehow, and it looks like it has it in a lot of different ways.
It has it, and it's statistically challenging because the response rates are so high without the maintenance. And the durability looks to be impressive without the maintenance. Hopefully we'll show a difference based on the number of patients that we get for that study. So that's what we're doing. So what do I do?
Yeah, America's waiting. I'm guessing
America's
that
waiting,
you're going to say BR.
You know, knowing me, it's going to be BR. For young patients, it's hard not to give them R-hypercVAD until you look at those SWOG data. And they're no better than what we published in a CLGB study, but had transplant. But if you can get good durable responses with BR, and we have some excellent drugs for relapse patients now.
We did this really wild education thing at ASH where we had cases being presented in the community. It was just, and anyhow, there was a case of a patient who was thought to have follicular lymphoma, had a great response to BR. And one of the investigators said, you know, I think maybe you got the diagnosis wrong, as this was diffuse large B cell. So my question to you is, what do we know about BR or bendamustine in diffuse large B-cell? I mean, if this patient had it, he had a complete response.
Yeah, there are limited data, but there are some. There was a study presented at a European meeting a couple of years ago in patients over the age of 80 with previously untreated large cell lymphoma. And the response rate was reported to be 80% with 60% complete remissions. Phenomenal. The usual phrase, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. In the relapse setting, at a more recent meeting, was BR in relapse refractory large cell, and the response rate was in the range of 50%. It's a reasonable regimen to keep in mind, because if you've got an elderly patient, particularly someone who's got a lower than you would like to have ejection fraction, what do you do with them? One potential regimen is R-bendamustine.
Wow, I mean, that sounds a little intimidating to think about that with that little data out there, but I guess you don't have that many choices in that situation.
Right. There are some other regimens. There was a regimen which was CHOP, but with a etoposide instead of the anthracycline, and that had some very promising response rates. But again, these are abstracts in relatively small numbers of patients.
Just out of curiosity, how do you generally approach an older patient with heart disease who has diffuse large B-cell and needs treatment?
Well, the last couple we treated with this CHOP using the etoposide regimen.
What about liposomal doxorubicin? Has that been looked at?
It has not, and that's a major issue that was not developed for this particular indication. There have been other drugs developed for this indication which didn't fly, but liposomal doxorubicin of one variety or other would be worth studying in this patient group.
So as usual, this has been the wild circus ride talking to you today. Why don't we just finish up? I just want to ask you, just in general, looking back over the last 6 months or year, including the ASH meeting, just overall in the field, any other papers or data sets that have come out that caught your eye?
Yes. The lenalidomide and mantle cell lymphoma data are exciting. It's about a 50% response rate. I have a patient who's just had 3.5 years of a remission after failing R-hyper-CVAD and autologous transplant. There is a pivotal study being completed by the company looking at that. Hopefully that will be on the market. I've already mentioned all the exciting data with CAL-101 and the BTK inhibitor, and there are other BTK inhibitors out there. One of the really interesting studies was something actually we came up with a couple of years ago, but it took those years to get it through the NCI and then was done by one of my former fellows, is what's called the R-squared regimen. This is rituximab and lenalidomide. And in patients with previously untreated follicular and low-grade lymphoma, the response rate was almost 90% and was 100% in the folliculars. And with most of those being complete remissions, we don't have any duration or response data yet. So now in CLGB, we finally got the study open after 2.5 years. So hopefully we'll confirm that.
But eligibility?
Previously untreated, low flippy.
Age?
Low and intermediate flippy.
Any age? You assume it's going to be older people or not necessarily?
No, not necessarily.
I mean, would you put a younger patient on the study?
Absolutely.
Really?
We put younger patients on our double antibody studies, and they're in remission for 3-4 years. No chemo. When they come back, we can give them other biological therapies now, whether it be lenalidomide-based therapy, another antibody, CAL-101, the BTK inhibitor. But I think one of the most exciting drugs out there, unfortunately for a fairly narrow menu of diseases, is brentuximab vedotin, which is SGN35. We had this antibody, SGN30, an anti-CD30, and in the treatment of Hodgkin's, it was kind of inactive. In the treatment of anaplastic large cell, it had a little activity. And then you conjugate it to MMAE, which is an auristatin, a tubulin poison. And what do you get? In Hodgkin's disease, you get Hodgkin's lymphoma, you get a response rate of 75% in relapsed refractory patients with a fair number of complete remissions. And in relapsed refractory anaplastic large cell, you get a response rate of 86%, most of which are complete remissions. And we've never seen the likes of this before. And it's a drug given intravenously every 3 weeks. It's well tolerated. There's a little neurotoxicity. There's some thrombocytopenia. Responses tend to occur relatively quickly. Very exciting. And it is now being combined with other regimens and other drugs and moved up earlier in the course of the disease to take advantage of what seems to be an exceptionally exciting drug.
Yeah, I'm trying to learn how to pronounce brentuximab, but I hear you can call it B-vedotin. I like that better, but anyhow, I guess...
We're still calling it SGN35.
SGN35.
It's a proof of principle because the naked antibody did nothing. You throw in the poison, and there are other drug antibody conjugates out there. Which
this is a Trojan horse kind of thing. Yeah. It delivers it to the cell.
Right. Brings it inside the cell where it's released and kills the cell. There is inotuzumab, which is another anti-CD22 bound to a poison. Same thing, gets high response rates in follicular lymphomas, respectable response rates in large cell. We're studying another one of those antibody conjugates at our institution. This is where we're going. We're getting away from the nonspecific cytotoxic drugs and moving towards these targeted agents, delivering radiation, delivering chemo, delivering toxins specifically to the lymphoma cell with remarkable response rates.
Do you know to what extent it's similar to the agent T-DM1 in breast cancer? Was it just trastuzumab maytansine conjugate?
It's a similar idea.
What's the spectrum of CD30 disease that, you know, conceivably this drug could be used for?
It's very limited, unfortunately. It is Hodgkin's lymphoma, classical type, not NLP Hodgkin's. It is anaplastic large cell, and about a third of the other T-cell lymphomas are CD30 positive.
And that's it?
That's pretty much it. But, you know, when we had imatinib that came out, it was hard to get companies interested in it because, hey, it's CML. But then you find something else that it does. You know, there's GIST and other things they're looking at with this drug.
Yeah.
It's possible that other diseases that haven't been looked at that will turn out to be CD30 positive that haven't been examined for that before or some other use. But the important thing, it's a proof of concept that now we know you can hook an antibody to a toxin and it will have successful response rates, better than you'd get with the antibody alone.
You know, it's interesting, though, thinking about other tumors. I mean, next week, we're going to the ASCO GI meeting. One of the things we're going to be talking about is trastuzumab in gastric cancer.
Right.
So, you know, more the idea of the target rather than the sort of the primary tumor.
Right.
I take it that's where you think we're going?
Absolutely. Chemotherapy will be history. It's all going to be biological approaches. We're doing that in the indolent diseases more and more. And hopefully we'll get to a point where we can do it in the more aggressive diseases.